The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 9, Side 2. The pickets shouldered pikes as they went to take up their posts for the night. The women's platoon on their way at night to rooms provided in the men's camp, so that they could rush out to meet the attackers if the alarm was raised. It was naively assumed that the butchers would be ashamed to hurt women, also bristled with pikes. All this would have been impossible, would have been ruined by mockers or lechers, if the stern and cleansing wind of rebellion had not been blowing through the camp. In our age, these pikes, these sabres, were children's toys, but for these people, prison, prison behind them, and prison before them, was no game. The pikes were playthings, but this was what fate had sent, their first chance to defend their freedom. In the puritanical air of that revolutionary springtime, when the presence of women on the barricades itself became a weapon, men and women behaved with proper dignity, and with dignity carried their pikes, points skyward. If anyone during those days entertained hopes of vile orgies, it was the blue epauletted bosses on the other side of the fence. Their calculation was that, left alone for a week, the prisoners would drown in their debauchery. That was the picture they painted for the inhabitants of the settlement, prisoners mutinying for the sake of sexual indulgence. Obviously, there was no other lack they could feel in their comfortable existence. After the mutiny, the bosses had the effrontery to carry out a general medical examination of all the women. When they discovered that many were still virgins, they were flabbergasted. Eh? What were you thinking of? All those days together? In their judgment of events, they could not rise above their own moral plane. The main hope of the authorities was that the thieves would start raping women, that the politicals would intervene, and that there would be a massacre. But once again, the MVD psychologists were wrong, and we ourselves may well be surprised. All witnesses agree that the thieves behaved like decent people, but in our sense of the term, not in their own traditional sense. On their side, the politicals and the women themselves emphasized by their behavior that they regarded the thieves as friends and trusted them. What lay below these attitudes need not concern us here. Perhaps the thieves kept remembering their comrades bloodily murdered that first Sunday. If we can speak of the strength of the Kangia revolt at all, its strength was in this unity. Nor did the thieves touch the food stores, which, for those who know them, is no less surprising. Although there was enough food for many months in the storerooms, the commission, after due consideration, decided to leave the allowances of bread and other foodstuffs as before. The honest citizen's fear of eating more than his share of public victuals and having to answer for this waste. As though the state owed the prisoners nothing for all those hungry years. On the other hand, as Mikheyev recalls, when there was a shortage outside the camp, the supply section of the camp administration asked the prisoners to release certain foodstuffs. There was some fruit, intended for those on higher norms, free workers, and the Zeks released it. The camp bookkeepers allocated foodstuffs on the old norms. The kitchen took them and cooked them, but in the new revolutionary atmosphere did not pilfer, nor did emissaries from the thieves appear with instructions to bring the stuff for the people. Nothing extra was ladled out for the trustees, and it was suddenly found that though the norms were the same, there was notably more to eat. If the thieves sold things, things previously stolen in other places, they did not, as had been their custom, immediately come along to take them back again. "Things are different now," they said. The stalls belonging to the local workers' supply department went on trading inside the camp. The staff guaranteed the safety of the cashier, a free woman. She was allowed into the camp and went around the stalls with two girls, collecting the takings, in vouchers, from the salespeople. But the vouchers, of course, soon ran out, and the bosses did not let new stocks through into the camp. The supply of three items needed in the camp remained in the hands of the bosses, electricity, water, and medicines. They did not, of course, control the air supply. As for medicines, they gave the camp not a single powder nor a single drop of iodine in 40 days. The electricity they cut off after 2 or 3 days. The water supply they left alone. The technical department began a fight for light. Their first idea was to fix hooks to fine wires and sling them forcibly over the outside cable, which ran just beyond the camp wall. And in this way they stole current for a few days, until the tentacles were discovered and cut. This had given the technical department time to try out a windmill, abandon it, and begin installing in the service yard, in a spot concealed from prying eyes on the towers or low-flying observation planes, a hydroelectric station worked by a water tap. A motor which happened to be in the yard was converted into a generator, and they started supplying the camp telephone network, the lighting in staff headquarters, and the radio transmitter. The huts were lit by wood splints. This unique hydroelectric station went on working till the last day of the revolt. In the very early days of the mutiny, the generals would come into the camp as though they owned it. True, Kuznetsov was not at a loss. When the first parleys took place, he ordered his men to bring the bodies from the morgue, and loudly ordered, "Caps off!" The zecs bared their heads, and the generals, too, had to take off their peaked caps in the presence of their victims. But the initiative remained with Gulag's General Botchkov. After approving the election of a commission, "You can't talk to everybody at once," he demanded that the negotiators tell him first how their cases had been investigated, and Kuznetsov began lengthily and perhaps eagerly presenting his story, and further insisted that prisoners should stand up to speak. When somebody said, "The prisoners demand," Botchkov touchily retorted that "prisoners cannot demand, they can only request," and "the prisoners request" became the established formula. Botchkov replied to the prisoners' requests with a lecture on the building of socialism, the unprecedentedly rapid progress of the economy, and the successes of the Chinese Revolution. That complacent irrelevancy, that driving of screws into the brain which always leaves us weak and numb. He had come into the camp to look for evidence that the use of firearms had been justified. They would shortly declare that in fact there had been no shooting in the camp. This was just a lie told by the gangsters. Nor had there been any beatings. He was simply amazed that they should dare ask him to infringe the instruction concerning the separate housing of men and women prisoners. They talked this way about their instructions, as though they were laws for and from all time. Shortly, other, more important generals arrived in Douglas aircraft. Dolgich, at that time allegedly head of Gulag, and Yegorov, deputy minister of internal affairs for the USSR. A meeting was called in the mess hall, and some 2,000 prisoners assembled. Kuznetsov gave the orders. "Silence, please! All stand! Attention!" And respectfully invited the generals to sit on the dais, while he, as befitted his subordinate rank, stood to one side. Sluchenkov behaved differently. When one of the generals casually spoke of enemies present, Sluchenkov answered in a clear voice, "How many of your sort turned out to be enemies? Yagoda was a public enemy. Yezhov was a public enemy. Abakumov was a public enemy. Beria was a public enemy. How do we know that Kruglov is any better?" Makeyev, to judge from his notes, drew up a draft agreement in which the authorities promised not to transfer people to other camps or otherwise victimize them, and to begin a thorough investigation, while the zecs in return agreed to return to work immediately. However, when he and his supporters started going around the huts and asking prisoners to accept his draft, they were jeered at as bald-headed komsomols, procurement agents, and lackeys of the Cheka. They got a particularly hostile reception in the women's camp, and found that the separation of the men's and women's divisions was by now the last thing the zecs would agree to. Makeyev angrily answered his opponents, "Just because you've had your hand on some wench's tits, do you think the Soviet regime is a thing of the past? The Soviet regime will get its own way, whatever happens." The days ran on. They never took their eyes off the camp grounds, soldiers' eyes from the towers, and warders' eyes, too. The warders, knowing the zecs by sight, were supposed to identify them and remember who did what. And even the eyes of airmen, perhaps equipped with cameras, and the generals were regretfully forced to conclude that there were no massacres, no pogroms, no violence in there, that the camp was not disintegrating of its own accord, and that there was no excuse to send troops in to the rescue. The camp stood fast, and the negotiations changed their character. Golden epauletted personages, in various combinations, continued coming into the camp to argue and persuade. They were all allowed in, but they had to pick up white flags, and between the outer gate of the service yard, now the main entrance, and the barricade, they had to undergo a body search, with some Ukrainian girl slapping the general's pockets, in case there was a pistol or a hand grenade in them. In return, the rebel staff guaranteed their personal safety. They showed the generals around, wherever it was allowed, not, of course, around the secret sector of the service yard, let them talk to prisoners, and called big meetings in the camp divisions for their benefit. Their epaulettes flashing, the bosses took their seats in the presidium, as of old, as though nothing were amiss. The prisoners put up speakers, but speaking was so difficult, not only because each of them, as he spoke, was writing his future sentence, but also because, in their experience of life and their ideas of truth, the greys and the blues had grown too far apart, and there was hardly any way of penetrating, of letting some light into, those plump and prosperous carcasses, those glossy, melon-shaped heads. They seemed to have been greatly angered by an old Leningrad worker, a communist who had taken part in the revolution. He asked them what chance communism had when officers got fat on the output of camp workshops, when they had lead stolen from the separating plant and made into shot for their poaching trips, when prisoners had to dig their kitchen gardens for them, when carpets were laid in the bathhouse for the camp commander's visits, and an orchestra accompanied his ablutions. To cut out some of this disorganized shouting, the discussions sometimes took the form of direct negotiations on the loftiest diplomatic model. Sometime in June, a long mess table was placed in the women's camp, and the golden epaulettes seated themselves on a bench to one side of it, while the Tommy gunners, allowed in with them as a bodyguard, stood at their backs. Across the table sat the members of the commission, and they too had a bodyguard, which stood there looking very serious, armed with sabres, pikes, and slingshots. In the background, crowds of prisoners gathered to listen to the powwow and shout comments. Refreshments for the guests were not forgotten. Fresh cucumbers were brought from the hothouses in the service yard, and kvass from the kitchen. The golden epaulettes crunched cucumbers unselfconsciously. The rebels had agreed on their demands, or requests, in the first 2 days, and now repeated them over and over again. Punish the evangelist's murderer. Punish all those responsible for the murders on Sunday night in the service yard. Punish those who beat up the women. Bring back those comrades who had been illegally sent to closed prisons for striking. No more number patches, window bars, or locks on hut doors. Inner walls between camp divisions not to be rebuilt. An 8-hour day, as for free workers. An increase in payment for work. Here there was no question of equality with free workers. Unrestricted correspondence with relatives, periodic visits. Review of cases. Although there was nothing unconstitutional in any of these demands, nothing that threatened the foundations of the state, indeed many of them were requests for a return to the old position, it was impossible for the bosses to accept even the least of them, because these bald skulls under service caps and supported by close-clipped fat necks had forgotten how to admit a mistake or a fault. Truth was unrecognizable and repulsive to them if it manifested itself not in secret instructions from higher authority, but on the lips of common people. Still, the obduracy of the 8,000 under siege was a blot on the reputation of the generals. It might ruin their careers, and so they made promises. They promised that nearly all the demands would be satisfied, only, they said, to make it more convincing, they could hardly leave the women's camp open. That was against the rules, forgetting that in the corrective labor camps it had been that way for 20 years, that they could consider arranging, should they say, meeting days. to the demand that the Commission of Inquiry into the circumstances of the shooting should start its work inside the camp, the generals unexpectedly agreed. But Sluchenkov guessed their purpose and refused to hear of it. While making their statements, the stoolies would expose everything that was happening in the camp. Review of cases? Well, of course, cases would be re-examined, but prisoners would have to be patient. There was one thing that couldn't wait at all. The prisoners must get back to work. To work, to work. But the Zeks knew that trick by now, dividing them up into columns, forcing them to the ground at gunpoint, arresting the ringleaders. No, they answered across the table and from the platform. No, shouted voices from the crowd. The administration of Steplag have behaved like provocateurs. We do not trust the Steplag authorities. We don't trust the MVD. Don't trust even the MVD? The vice minister was thrown into a sweat by this treasonable talk. And who can have inspired in you such hatred for the MVD? A riddle, if ever there was one. Send us a member of the Central Committee Presidium. A member of the Presidium. Then we'll believe you, shouted the Zeks. Be careful, the general threatened. You'll make it worse for yourselves. At this, Kuznetsov got up. He spoke calmly and precisely, and he held himself proudly. If you enter the camp with weapons, he warned them, don't forget that half of those here had a hand in the capture of Berlin. They can cope, even with your weapons. Capitan Kuznetsov. Some future historian of the Kengia mutiny must help us to understand the man better. What were his thoughts? How did he feel about his imprisonment? What stage did he imagine his appeal to have reached? How long was it since he had asked for a review, if the order of release, with rehabilitation, I believe, arrived from Moscow during the rebellion? His pride in keeping the mutinous camp in such good order, was it only the professional pride of a military man? Had he put himself at the head of the movement because it captured his imagination? I reject that explanation. Or, knowing his powers of leadership, had he taken over to restrain the movement, tame the flood, and channel it, to lay his chastened comrades at their master's feet? That is my view. In meetings and discussions, and through people of lesser importance, he had opportunities to tell those in charge of the punitive operation anything he liked, and to hear things from them. On one occasion in June, for instance, the artful dodger Makosyan was sent out of camp on an errand for the commission. Did Kuznetsov exploit such opportunities? Perhaps not. His position may have been a proud and independent one. Two bodyguards, two enormous Ukrainian lads, accompanied Kuznetsov the whole time with knives in their belts. To defend him, to settle scores. Makeyev claims that during the rebellion Kuznetsov also had a temporary wife, another Ukrainian nationalist. Gleb Sluchenkov was about 30, which means that he must have been captured by the Germans when he was 19 or so. Like Kuznetsov, he now went around in his old uniform, which had been kept in storage, acting or overacting the old soldier. He had a slight limp, but the speed of his movements made it unimportant. In the negotiations, he was precise to the point of curtness. The authorities had the idea of calling all former juvenile offenders out of the camp, youngsters jailed before they were 18, some of them now 20 or 21, and releasing them. This may not have been a trick. At about this time, they were releasing such prisoners or reducing their sentences all over the country. Sluchenkov's answer was, have you asked the miners whether they want to move from one camp to another and leave their comrades in the lurch? In the commission, too, he insisted that these kids carry out our guard duties. We can't hand them over. This indeed was the unspoken reason why the generals wanted to release these youngsters while Kengir was in revolt. And for all we know, they would have shoved them in cells outside the camp. The law-abiding Makeyev nonetheless began rounding up former juveniles for the discharge tribunal. And he testifies that out of 409 persons with a claim to be released, he only succeeded in collecting 13 who were willing to leave. If we bear in mind Makeyev's sympathy with the authorities and his hostility to the Rising, his testimony is amazing. 400 youngsters in the bloom of youth, and in their great majority not politically minded, renounced not merely freedom, but salvation, and stayed with the doomed revolt. Sluchinkov's reply to threats that troops would be used to put down the revolt was, "Send them in. Send as many Tommy gunners as you like. We'll throw ground glass in their eyes and take their guns from them. We'll trounce your Kangir troops. Your bow-legged officers will chase all the way to Karaganda. We'll ride into Karaganda on your backs. And once there, we're among friends." There is other evidence about him which seems reliable. "Anybody who runs away will get this in the chest," flourishing a hunting knife in the air. "Anybody who doesn't turn out to defend the camp will get the knife," he announced in one hut. The inevitable logic of any military authority and any war situation. The newborn camp government, like all governments through the ages, was incapable of existing without a security service, and Sluchinkov headed this, occupying the security officer's room in the women's camp. Since there could be no victory over the outside forces, Sluchinkov realized that this post meant certain execution. In the course of the revolt, he told people in the camp that the bosses had secretly urged him to provoke a racial bloodbath. The golden epaulettes were banking heavily on this, and so provide a plausible excuse for troops to enter the camp. In return, the bosses promised Sluchinkov his life. He rejected their proposal. What approaches were made to others, they haven't told us. Moreover, when a rumor went around the camp that a Jewish pogrom was imminent, Sluchinkov gave warning that the rumor-mongers would be publicly flogged. The rumor died down. A clash between Sluchinkov and the loyalists seemed inevitable, and it happened. It should be said that all these years, in all the special camps, Orthodox Soviet citizens, without even consulting each other, unanimously condemned the massacre of the Stoolies, or any attempt by prisoners to fight for their rights. We need not put this down to sordid motives, though quite a few of the Orthodox were compromised by their work for the Godfather, since we can fully explain it by their theoretical views. They accepted all forms of repression and extermination, even wholesale, provided they came from above, as a manifestation of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Even impulsive and uncoordinated actions of the same kind, but from below, were regarded as banditry, and what is more, in its banderist form. Among the loyalists, you would never get one to admit the right of the Ukraine to secede, because to do so was bourgeois nationalism. The refusal of the Katorjana to be slave laborers, their indignation about window bars and shootings, depressed and frightened the docile camp communists. In Kengir, as elsewhere, there was a nest of loyalists, Genkin, Apfelzweig, Talalyevsky, and evidently Akoyev. We have no more names. There was also a malingerer who spent years in the hospital pretending that his leg kept going around. Intellectual methods of struggle such as this were deemed permissible. In the commission itself, Makeyev was an obvious example. All of them were reproachful from the beginning. "You shouldn't have started it." When the passages under the walls were blocked off, they said that they shouldn't have tunneled. It was all a stunt thought up by the banderist scum, and the thing to do now was to back down quickly. Anyway, the 16 killed were not from their camp, and it was simply silly to shed tears over the evangelist. All their bile and bigotry is blurted out in Makeyev's notes. Everything and everybody in sight is bad, and there are dangers on every hand. It's either a new sentence from the bosses, or a knife in the back from the banderists. "They want to frighten us all with their bits of iron and drive us to our deaths," Makeyev angrily calls the Kangir revolt. "A bloody game, a false trump, amateur dramatics on the part of the banderists. And more often than any of these, the wedding party." The hopes and aims of the leaders, as he sees them, were fornication, evasion of work, and putting off the day of reckoning. That there was a reckoning to be paid, he tacitly assumes to be just. This very accurately expresses the attitude of the loyalists in the 50s to the freedom movement in the camps, whereas Makeyev was very cautious and was indeed among the leaders of the revolt. Taralievsky poured out such complaints quite openly, and Sluchinkov's internal security service locked him in a cell in the Kengir jailhouse for agitation hostile to the rebels. Yes, this really happened. The rebels who had liberated the jail now set up one of their own. The old, old, ironical story. True, only four men were put inside for various reasons, usually for dealings with the bosses, and none of them was shot. Instead, they were presented with the best of alibis for the authorities. This incident apart, the jailhouse, a particularly gloomy old place built in the 30s, was put on display to a wide public. It had windowless, solitary confinement cells with nothing but a tiny skylight, legless beds, mere wooden boards on the cement floor, where it was still colder and damper than elsewhere in the cold cell. And beside each bed, which means down on the floor, a rough earthenware bowl like a dog dish. To this place, the agitation department organized sightseeing trips for their fellow prisoners who had never been inside, and perhaps never would be. They also took there visiting generals, who were not greatly impressed. They even asked that sightseers from among the free inhabitants of the settlement be sent along. With the prisoners absent, they could in any case do nothing at the work sites. The generals actually sent such a party, not, of course, ordinary working men, but hand-picked personnel who found nothing to excite indignation. In reply, the authorities offered to arrange a prisoners' outing to Rudnik, Divisions 1 and 2 of Steplag, since, according to camp rumours, a revolt had broken out there, too. Incidentally, for their own good reasons, both slaves and slave masters shunned the word revolt, or still worse, rising, replacing them with the bashful euphemism horseplay. The delegates went and saw for themselves that all was as it had been, that prisoners were going to work. Their hopes largely depended on strikes like their own spreading. Now the delegates returned with cause for despondency. The authorities, in fact, had taken them there only just in time. Rudnik was, of course, worked up. Prisoners had heard from free workers all sorts of facts and fantasies about the Kengir revolt. In the same month, June, it so happened that many appeals for judicial review were turned down simultaneously. Then some half-crazy lad was wounded in the prohibited area, and there, too, a strike started. The gates between camp divisions were knocked down, and prisoners poured out onto the central road. Machine guns appeared on the towers. Somebody hung up a placard with anti-Soviet slogans on it, and the rallying cry, "Freedom or death!" But this was taken down and replaced by one with legitimate demands, and an undertaking to make up for losses caused by the stoppage once the demands were satisfied. Lorries came to fetch flour from the storerooms. The prisoners wouldn't let them have it. The strike lasted for something like a week, but we have no precise information about it. This is all at third hand, and probably exaggerated. There were weeks when the whole war became a war of propaganda. The outside radio was never silent. Through several loudspeakers set up at intervals around the camp, it interlarded appeals to the prisoners with information and misinformation, and with a couple of trite and boring records that frayed everybody's nerves. "Through the meadow goes a maiden, she whose braided hair I love." Still, to be thought worthy even of that not very high honour, having records played to them, they had to rebel. Even rubbish like that wasn't played for men on their knees. These records also served, in the spirit of the times, as a jamming device, drowning the broadcasts from the camps intended for the escort troops. On the outside radio, they sometimes tried to blacken the whole movement, asserting that it had been started with the sole aim of rape and plunder. In the camp itself, the Zeks just laughed, but the free inhabitants of the settlement also listened, willy-nilly, to the loudspeakers. Of course, the slave masters could not rise to any other explanation. An admission that this rabble was capable of seeking justice was far beyond the reach of their minds. At other times, they tried telling filthy stories about members of the commission. They even said that one of the old ones, when he was being transported by barge to the Kolyma, had made a hole below the waterline and sunk the boat with 300 zecs in it. The emphasis was on the fact that it was poor zecs he had drowned, practically all of them 58s too, and not the escort troops. How he had survived himself was not clear. Or else they would taunt Kuznetsov, telling him that his discharge had arrived but was now cancelled. Then the appeals would begin again. Work, work. Why should the motherland keep you for nothing? By not going to work, you are doing enormous damage to the state. This was supposed to pierce the hearts of men doomed to eternal katorga. Whole train loads of coal are standing in the siding. There's nobody to unload it. Let them stand there, the zecs laughed. You'll give way all the sooner. Yet it didn't occur even to them that the golden epaulettes could unload it themselves if it troubled them so much. The technical department, however, gave as good as it got. Two portable film projectors were found in the service yard. Their amplifiers were used for loudspeakers, less powerful, of course, than those of the other side. They were fed from the secret hydroelectric station. The fact that the camp had electricity and radio greatly surprised and troubled the bosses. They were afraid that the rebels might rig up a transmitter and start broadcasting news about their rising to foreign countries. Rumours to this effect were also put around inside the camp. The camp soon had its own announcers. Slava Yalimovskaya is one we know of. Programmes included the latest news and news features. There was also a daily wall newspaper with cartoons. Crocodile Tears was the name of a program ridiculing the anxiety of the MVD men about the fate of women whom they themselves had previously beaten up. Then there were programs for the escort troops. Apart from this, prisoners would approach the towers at night and shout to the soldiers through megaphones. But there was not enough power to put on programs for the only potential sympathizers to be found in Kengir, the free inhabitants of the settlement, many of them exiles. It was they whom the settlement authorities were trying to fool, not by radio, but in some place which the prisoners could not reach, with rumours that bloodthirsty gangsters and insatiable prostitutes, this version went down well with the women, were ruling the roost inside the camp. When it was all over and the women's column was marched through the settlement on the way to work, married women, Russian women, gathered along the roadside and shouted at them, "Prostitutes! Dirty whores! Couldn't do without it, could you?" And other, still stronger remarks. The same thing happened next day, but the women prisoners had left the camp prepared and replied to these insulting creatures with a bombardment of stones. The escort troops just laughed. That over there, innocent people were being tortured and burned alive in furnaces. In that case, it was hard to see why the authorities did not intervene. How could the prisoners call out through the walls to the workers 1 or 2 or 3 kilometers away? "Brothers, we want only justice. They were murdering us for no crime of ours. They were treating us worse than dogs. Here are our demands." The thoughts of the technical department, since they had no chance to outstrip modern science, moved backwards instead to the science of past ages. Using cigarette paper, it was everything you could think of in the service yard. We have talked about that already. For many years, it provided the Jezhkezgan officers with their own Moscow tailor's shop and a workshop for every imaginable article of consumer goods. They pasted together an enormous air balloon, following the example of the Montgolfier brothers. A bundle of leaflets was attached to the balloon, and slung underneath it was a brazier containing glowing coals, which sent a current of warm air into the dome of the balloon through an opening in its base. To the huge delight of the assembled crowd, if prisoners ever do feel happy, they are like children, the marvellous aeronautical structure rose and was airborne. But alas, the speed of the wind was greater than the speed of its ascent, and as it was flying over the boundary fence, the brazier caught on the barbed wire. The balloon, denied its current of warm air, fell and burned to ashes, together with the leaflets. After this failure, they started inflating balloons with smoke. With the following wind, they flew quite well, exhibiting inscriptions in large letters to the settlement. Save the women and old men from being beaten. We demand to see a member of the Presidium. The guards started shooting at these balloons. Then some Chechen prisoners came to the technical department and offered to make kites. They are experts. They succeeded in sticking some kites together and paying out the string until they were over the settlement. There was a percussive device on the frame of each kite. When the kite was in a convenient position, the device scattered a bundle of leaflets, also attached to the kite. The kite flyer sat on the roof of a hut, waiting to see what would happen next. If the leaflets fell close to the camp, warders ran to collect them. If they fell farther away, motorcyclists and horsemen dashed after them. Whatever happened, they tried to prevent the free citizens from reading an independent version of the truth. The leaflets ended by requesting any citizen of Kengir who found one to deliver it to the Central Committee. The kites were also shot at, but holing was less damaging to them than to the balloons. The enemy soon discovered that sending up counter-kites to tangle strings with them was cheaper than keeping a crowd of warders on the run. A war of kites in the second half of the 20th century, and all to silence a word of truth. Perhaps it will help the reader to place the events at Kengir chronologically if we recall what was happening outside during the days of the mutiny. The Geneva Conference on Indochina was in session. The Stalin Peace Prize was conferred on Pierre Cotte. Another progressive Frenchman, the writer Sartre, arrived in Moscow to join in the life of our progressive society. The third centenary of the reunification of Russia and the Ukraine was loudly and lavishly celebrated. The Ukrainians at Kengir declared it a day of mourning. On May the 31st, there was a solemn parade on Red Square. The Ukrainian SSR and the Russian SFSR were awarded the Order of Lenin. On June the 6th, a monument to Yuri Dolgoruki was unveiled in Moscow. A trade union congress opened on June the 8th, but nothing was said there about Kengir. On the 10th, a new state loan was launched. The 20th was Air Force Day, and there was a splendid parade at Tushino. These months of 1954 were also marked by a powerful offensive on the literary front, as people call it. Surkov, Korchetov, and Yermilov came out with very tough admonitory articles. Korchetov even asked, "What sort of times are we living in?" And nobody answered, "A time of prison camp risings." Many incorrect plays and books were abused during this period, and in Guatemala the imperialistic United States met with the rebuff it deserved. There were Chechen exiles in the settlement, but it is unlikely that they made the other kites. You cannot accuse the Chechens of ever having served oppression. They understood perfectly the meaning of the Kengir revolt, and on one occasion brought a bakery van up to the gates. Needless to say, the soldiers drove them away. There is more than one side to the Chechens. People among whom they live, I speak from my experience in Kazakhstan, find them hard to get along with. They are rough and arrogant, and they do not conceal their dislike of Russians. But the men of Kengir only had to display independence and courage, and they immediately won the goodwill of the Chechens. When we feel that we are not sufficiently respected, we should ask ourselves whether we are living as we should. In the meantime, the technical department was getting its notorious secret weapon ready. Let me describe it. Aluminum corner brackets for cattle troughs, produced in the workshops and awaiting dispatch, were packed with a mixture of sulfur scraped from matches and a little calcium carbide. Every box of matches had been carried off to the room with a 100,000-volt door. When the sulfur was lit and the brackets thrown, they hissed and burst into little pieces. But neither these star-crossed geniuses nor the field staff in the bathhouse were to choose the hour, place, and form of the decisive battle. Some 2 weeks after the beginning of the revolt, on one of those dark nights without a glimmer of light anywhere, thuds were heard at several places around the camp wall. This time it was not escaping prisoners or rebels battering it down. The wall was being demolished by the convoy troops themselves. There was commotion in the camp as prisoners charged around with pikes and sabers, unable to make out what was happening and expecting an attack. but the troops did not take the offensive. In the morning, it turned out that the enemy without had made about a dozen breaches in the wall, in addition to those already there and the barricaded gateway. Machine gun posts had been set up on the other side of the gaps to prevent the Zeks from pouring through them. The precedent is said to have been set by Norilsk. There, too, they made breaches in the walls to lure out the faint-hearted, who would be used to stir up the thieves, and so provide an excuse to introduce troops and restore order. This was, of course, the preliminary for an assault through the breaches, and the camp was a seething anthill as it prepared to defend itself. The rebel staff decided to pull down the inner walls and the mud-brick outhouses, and to erect a second circular wall of their own, specially reinforced with stacks of brick where it faced the gaps, to give protection against machine-gun bullets. How things had changed! The troops were demolishing the boundary wall, the prisoners were rebuilding it, and the thieves were helping with a clear conscience, not feeling that they were contravening their code. Additional defense posts now had to be established opposite the gaps, and every platoon assigned to a gap, which it must run to defend, should the alarm be raised at night. Bangs on the buffer of a railroad car, and the usual whistles, were the agreed-upon alarm signals. The Zeks quite seriously prepared to advance against machine guns with pikes. Those who shied at the idea to begin with soon got used to it. There was one attack in the daytime. Tommy gunners were moved up to one of the gaps opposite the balcony of the Steplag administration building, which was packed with important personages, sheltering under broad army epaulets or the narrow ones of the public prosecutor's department, and holding cameras or even movie cameras. The soldiers were in no hurry. They merely advanced just far enough into the breach for the alarm to be given, whereupon the rebel platoons responsible for the defense of the breach rushed out to man the barricade, brandishing their pikes and holding stones and mud bricks. And then, from the balcony, movie cameras whirred and pocket cameras clicked, taking care to keep the Tommy gunners out of the picture. Disciplinary officers, prosecutors, party officials, and all the rest of them, party members to a man, of course, laughed at the bizarre spectacle of the impassioned savages with pikes. Well-fed and shameless, these grand personages mocked their starved and cheated fellow citizens from the balcony and found it all very funny. These photographs must still exist somewhere, gummed to reports on the punitive operation. Perhaps somebody will not be swift enough to destroy them before posterity sees them. Then warders, too, stole up to the gaps and tried to slip nooses with hooks over the prisoners, as though they were hunting wild animals or the abominable snowman, hoping to drag out a talker. But what they mainly counted on now were deserters, rebels with cold feet. The radio blared away. "Come to your senses! Leave the camp through the gaps in the wall! At those points we shall not fire! Those who come over will not be tried for mutiny!" The commission's response over the camp radio was this: "Anybody who wants to run away can go right ahead, through the main gate if he likes. We are holding no one back." One who did so was a member of the commission itself, former Major Makayev, who walked up to the main guardhouse as though he had business there. As though, not because they would have detained him, nor because they had the means of shooting him in the back, but because it is almost impossible to play the traitor with your comrades looking on and howling their contempt. Even 10 years later he was so ashamed that in his memoirs, which were probably designed to serve as an apologia, he writes that he chanced to put his head out of the gate where the other side pounced on him and tied his hands. For 3 weeks he had kept up a pretense. Now at last he could give free rein to his defeatism and his anger with the rebels for wanting the freedom which he, Makayev, did not want. Now, working off his debts to the bosses, he broadcast an appeal to surrender and reviled those who favored holding out longer. Here are some sentences from his own written account of this broadcast. "Somebody has decided that freedom can be won with the help of sabers and pikes. They want to expose to bullets people who won't take their bits of iron. We have been promised a review of our cases. The generals are patiently negotiating with us, but Sluchenkov regards this as a sign of weakness on their part. The commission is a screen for gangster debauchery. This book is continued on Cassette 10, Side 1.